Exodus chapter 1, verses 1 to 14, the second talk in a series on Exodus, was presented by David Crabtree on October 18, 2015, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 2, Exodus 1, 1 through 14, accompanies this talk.
Last week I gave some introductory material to the book of Exodus, and so now we're going to jump into the text itself. As I go through, my plan is to make some comments with respect to all kinds of aspects of the text. Sometimes it'll be lexical issues, sometimes cultural, sometimes philosophical, sometimes more personal issues. But I'm doing this because I think that it will be good for you to understand how I'm making sense of the text and what kinds of clues that I am basing my understanding on. So I'll be pointing out some of them, not all of them, and hopefully it will be in right proportion. And then at the end, I have several comments that I want to make on the passage that we'll be looking at. And the passage we'll be looking at today is relatively short, but seems to me that there's quite a bit to talk about in it. Last week and this week, I sent out an outline, and it is a lengthy outline. It is not my intention to inundate you with outlines. I'm experimenting, and I'm not sure whether I will continue to produce the outlines or not. That depends on a number of different factors. I did it last week because there were some dates that I wanted to make sure that you could, had in hand and could see. And this time in particular, there's a bibliography at the end. Roger asked me about books that I have been consulting, and so I have a list of some of the books at the end of the outline. As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter to me whether you use the outline or don't use the outline. If it's helpful, use it. If it's not helpful, then don't use it. And I will more or less follow it. Okay, the first section of Exodus, first few verses. Now these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. They came each one with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. And all the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Joseph was already in Egypt. And Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. It says that the sons of Israel came to Egypt. It's interesting that it uses the term sons of Israel. They are the sons of Jacob, but Jacob's name was changed as a result of his wrestling with the angel of God, and he was given a new name, Israel. And it is the sons of Israel, then, that's the designation that's used here rather than the sons of Jacob. I am convinced, having looked at Genesis, that the names that are given to people are significant. That's particularly true in the names of the sons of Jacob, that each one of those has a significance, particularly in the narrative, because it's telling you what the mothers are thinking when the child is born. And that's really the only clues you have as to what they are thinking as that part of the narrative passes by. The unfortunate thing is, in almost every case, it is unclear what the name means. So it's significant, but the meaning is unclear. And they seemed to like, in that period of time, giving names that are kind of a play on words. I have made up an example that I will use to illustrate this more or less. Let's say a mother is giving birth to a child. It's a long and difficult labor, and she's just about exhausted herself when the child is born. And the child is born, and the mother says, "I name him Peter, because I almost petered out. Well, the name Peter has a significance. It means rock, and there are things that go along with that. But in this context, the mother has drawn upon another meaning for the word just because of the circumstances that I was almost petered out. Well, the people in the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob liked to do that kind of thing. So with Jacob, he was named Jacob because when he was born, he was grasping the heel of his twin brother Esau. And the word Jacob, it sounds similar to the Hebrew word for heel. But what does Jacob mean? What is its actual meaning? And it is not entirely clear, but they think that it means El, or God, will protect him. God will protect him. Later, when his name is changed, it's changed to Israel. The meaning of this is more difficult. They think that in all likelihood, Israel means El will strive. In other words, God will strive. But there are a number of different hypotheses as to what this name will mean, what it meant, and so it's very uncertain. As Sarna says, none of the suggestions proposed to explain the verbal element has yielded satisfaction. Until more philological evidence is forthcoming, the true explanation escapes us. So they don't really know what Israel means. However, in the context of Genesis, when the name was given to Jacob, it is clear what it means because the angel explains it. As Hamilton says, note, however, that the reason for the name change is clear. Because you have struggled with God and with men, you have succeeded. The explanation for the name change focuses on what Jacob has done. He has struggled with God and he has succeeded with men. So the name that was given to Jacob is one of struggling both with God and with men. And you see that is the case with Jacob. Jacob struggled mightily with God, trying to come to terms with who God is. And it seems to me that it is interesting that that is the name that has been attached to his descendants because they have been characterized similarly, it seems to me. Over the years, they have struggled with God and have struggled with man. I think it was Rusty that was telling me that Moshe made the comment that all Israelites, all Jews, struggle with God to one degree or another, and that even an atheist Jew struggles with God, is God-haunted and has trouble coming to terms with him. Is that roughly correct? Good. And I think that's true, and I think that's what we see historically, is that it is probably the case that as a people group, Jews have struggled especially with who God is and come to terms with that. They have also, as a people group, they have struggled with other people groups trying to come to terms with that. And where does Israel as a nation, as a people, fit into mankind, into history? And that's been an ongoing struggle for them. So it is the sons of Israel, literally the sons of Israel, that go into Egypt, but they turn into a people who are also called the sons of Israel. Each son came with his household, which would mean his wife, his children, and his slaves, or servants, presumably. The names are all listed here of the sons of Jacob. They are listed in the order of the sons of his two wives, Leah and Rachel, followed by the sons of his two maids, by whom he had children as well. It mentions that Joseph was already in Egypt. The author of Exodus here is hinting back to how they got into Egypt. And that would recall the whole story of what happened and why that move was made. Then it says, and all the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Joseph was already in Egypt. So the number 70 is what it attaches to those who were descendants of Jacob that went into Israel. Now, this is a little problematic. It says there are 70 here. In Acts chapter 7, when Stephen is being accused by some of the Jews in Jerusalem of being basically a heretic, of being of teaching things that are false and blasphemous. And he goes through his account of the history of the people of Israel. And in that account, he refers to the sons of Jacob going down to Egypt. And he says that there are 75 that went down to Egypt. So here in text in Exodus, it says 70. What Stephen says in Acts is that there were 75. As I've been working through texts, in particular Old Testament texts, it is not uncommon for me to find what appear to be discrepancies in the text, ways in which the Bible just, it doesn't seem like it can possibly be true, because there are discrepancies or there are apparent errors. I am an inerrantist, but over the years, my thinking has changed with respect to that. My understanding of what is an error has changed. I've had to think a lot about that, what constitutes an error. And that is not an easy question. And I've also run into passages where the discrepancies that I found were genuinely troubling. And that's happened on several different occasions. There are ways in which this apparent discrepancy can be resolved, it seems to me. One of them is that the text here that we have, that I am reading from, which is based on the Masoretic text, that could be an error. It could be that it should have been 75, but that got changed to 70 some point along the line when it was being copied. The other possibility is, and I haven't mentioned this yet, but the number that's used in the Septuagint is 75. That's also the number that occurs in texts in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It could be that those are wrong. So one of those could have been corrupted and has become an error. Another possibility is that here in Exodus, it's being in the Masoretic text of Exodus is being used symbolically, whereas the exact number, the exact head count, has been passed down some other route, some other way, and is 75. And I'm sure there are other possible resolutions to it. As I have thought about this issue of inerrancy, it's important to me. If the Bible is not inerrant, then the Bible becomes a different kind of thing as I'm reading it. It has a different kind of authority. And so the issue is a significant issue. I am an inerrantist not because I have resolved every issue of apparent discrepancies or apparent errors. There are some of those that still exist unresolved as far as I'm concerned. But I'm an inerrantist because I have grown to have enormous faith in the text of the Bible, even in its minutiae, because there are so many times that I have seen the minutiae of the text shown to be true, shown to be borne out. And also, I'm convinced that it is the perspective of Jesus and the apostles that the Bible is inerrant, and Jack has talked about that before. But I'm convinced of inerrancy on those bases, not because it looks to me like all of the problems have been resolved, because I don't think that that's the case. There are many problems yet that need to be resolved. But I am quite willing to put those kinds of things on the back burner, and I have a back burner with a whole stack of things on it. Is this number an actual head count, or is it symbolic? And it used to be that I was very resistant to seeing numbers symbolically. I have since softened on that a bit, because I am convinced that numbers are sometimes used symbolically, especially in the Old Testament. And it's possible that that's the case here. But it's also possible that this is the actual head count. And if God is the author of history, it doesn't seem to me that it is implausible that God would make the symbolic line up with the actual head count. And I am confident that that happens sometimes. If it is symbolic, then those who know more than I do say that it probably symbolizes completeness. And here is a quote from Umberto Casuto, which is one of the authors I list in my bibliography in the back. And he's a fascinating fellow, a scholar, a Jew, grew up in Italy and was writing quite a bit in the 50s and 60s. and was one of those advocates for looking at the text as a unit in a period of time when higher criticism was dividing it up into the different sources from which it came. And I think his work shows how much benefit that comes from looking at the text as a unified whole. But he says, with respect to the number 70, this number 70 commonly indicates the perfection of a family blessed with offspring, both in the pre-Israelitic and in the Israelitic traditions. The Canaanites, as we know from the Ugaritic text, used to speak of the 70 sons of 70 descendants of Noah, and subsequently to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal, Gideon, and the 70 sons of Ahab. Similarly, Jacob's family was perfect in the number of its children, just as the nations of the entire world number 70, according to Genesis 10. So the children of Israel total 70. They form a small world that parallels the great world, a microcosm corresponding to the macrocosm. So in essence, then, the 70 would be indicating it is a complete family, a filled-out family. But, as the text goes on to indicate, it was not then a people. And what God had promised to Abraham is that Abraham's descendants would be a people. And that's what it's going to go on to explain. I'll point out that that number 70, according to Robert Alter, would have been a number that included males only, in all likelihood. Okay, so 70 people came down to Egypt when Jacob came, when he made the move. Since then, since that time, Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation have died off. So that is past history. We have moved on. The text doesn't make clear how far we've moved on, but we have moved on since that happened. And what has happened in the interim is that relatively small number, 70, has grown into a large number and is now a people. What God had promised to Abraham has been at least partially fulfilled. And the term, the sons of Israel, is now used to describe this people. Interestingly, in this section, there are a number of terms that are used that are reminiscent of the creation account in Genesis chapter 1. And I am convinced that the author is wanting us to associate what's going on here with the creation account in Genesis 1. And it seems to me that this kind of association happens often in the Old Testament texts. In a tight culture, in a culture in which people share the same cultural background information, it is easy for a writer or a speaker to allude to a whole bunch of associations that they want to make by just giving a word or a phrase. And I was thinking about this, and I was trying to think of a great example, and I came up with a wonderful example while I was riding my bike to work one day. But by the time I got there, I forgot what it was, and I can't recall it. So I came up with less good ones. But just take the phrase wardrobe malfunction. Everybody knows what that is. Everybody knows what's associated with that. And I was thinking, if the sole came off of my shoe, and I referred to that as a wardrobe malfunction, I think that'd be pretty funny, because it doesn't have any of the associations that go with the wardrobe malfunction when it occurred, because we all know what those associations are. Pursuit of happiness. Isn't that a phrase that people in American culture would understand? They know where that came from and the things that are associated with that. So if we had a tighter culture, one that shared more in common, where we all knew the same text very well, we could do a lot more of that. And that's the point of E.D. Hirsch's book, Cultural Literacy, which he wrote several years ago and which got a lot of bad comments. But that was essentially his point, was that we have lost that sense of a shared culture that we all are very familiar with and therefore can use to make associations that help us to communicate more easily. In any case, I'm convinced that both the Old Testament and the New Testament were written in that kind of culture, in which people easily made those same set of associations with words and with phrases, such that by using terms here in Exodus that are the same as the terms that are in Genesis 1, he is calling up a whole bunch of associations with that chapter and what happened in the creation account. And why would he do that? I think what's going on here is that he is likening the expansion of the family of Jacob, filling out, filling the earth, teeming, those kinds of words that were all in Genesis 1. He's using those kinds of words to say that, remember what happened in creation when God created the world? Well, God continues to be active here in creating his people. He's fulfilling the promise that he had made to Abraham, and he's bringing into being, out of nothing, ex nihilo, almost, his people. And I think that's the association that's intended. Okay, the overall importance of this section is that all appears to be good with God's people. That for however long they've been in Egypt, and it's not clear at this point, however long they've been there, that things are going well with respect to God fulfilling the promise that he had made to his people, that he had promised Abraham that he would make his descendants into a great nation, make them into a people. And so this is a partial fulfillment, and it looks like things are headed in the direction of that being fulfilled. In the outline, I had Genesis 48:8 written down, but that's not right. The promise that is made to Jacob is in 35:9-12. Jacob then repeats it in 48 verses 3 and 4, and that may have been what I was thinking, but you can correct that. The two parts of the promise that he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were that he would make Abraham's descendants into a people, into a great nation, and that they would possess the land of Canaan that God had given to them. So when we get to this point in Exodus, it looks like God is actively fulfilling the first part of that promise. He is bringing into being his people, but no mention here of the second part, giving them the land as a possession. Okay, next few verses. Now a new king arose over Egypt, who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And in the event of war, they also join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land." So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. And the Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks, and at all kinds of labor in the field, all their labors which they rigorously imposed upon them. Okay, a new king arose in Egypt, over Egypt, who did not know Joseph. Just a point of interest, the term used here early in Exodus is king. Typically, the leader of Egypt is referred to as Pharaoh, but in these first few chapters, it is more common for him to be referred to as king. Later on, it'll switch to Pharaoh. And what is the significance of that? I don't really know. I think it's a curious detail. I suspect that what's being emphasized here is the king as the head of state, as a powerful head of state. And later, when it switches to Pharaoh, it's going to be the head of Egyptian society, so more specifically Egyptian. But I'm not sure. Arose, the use of the term arose here, suggests, Sarna says, the inauguration of a new era. So when it says a king arose, that there's some really significant shift that is taking place. Now, it could be that it's just a new king. The previous king has died, and his son is taking the throne. And that could be what's going on, and it could be no more significant than that. But it suggests, though, that there's some kind of dramatic change. So there could be that there's a change in dynasty, that one dynasty has fallen out of power and it is actually a new dynasty that is being established at this point. It could also be that it's a whole new people that has come to a place of power. I talked last week about the fact that we know there was an invasion by the Hyksos. It's possible that it was the Hyksos before, and that now a king is arising who is not Hyksos at all, he's Egyptian. Or it could be the other way around, that it was Egyptian king that is gone and a Hyksos king that has taken power. All of those are possible. In any case, though, I think it's important to note that when a new king comes to power in the ancient world, to one degree or another, this is always the case, there is instability. Because the new king has to establish his authority. That people see that those changes in who is the ruler as opportunities for them to push for change that they haven't been able to get in the past. And they can push the new king very hard, and sometimes they can even threaten and revolt as the king is trying to establish his power. Just as a point of interest, in our political system, we are so used to a smooth transition from one president to another. There's so much continuity that we don't experience that kind of phenomenon. But in the ancient world, that happened. Whenever a new king came to power, that new king had to establish his power, had to establish his legitimacy and his authority. And that could be a dicey proposition. I think that that's the background that we see here. A new king arose in Egypt, and he is in a situation where he has to solidify his support behind him and solidify his position. This is a king who has no appreciation for the service of Joseph. Joseph, as we know, saved Egypt. That there was a time when Joseph saved Egypt. And so his service to Egypt was enormous. But that has been forgotten. So we have the first action in the book of Exodus. And the first action in the book of Exodus is the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, speaking to the people. And when he speaks to them, he points out that there is this group in their midst, that is the sons of Israel, that are in their midst. And he refers to them as the people, the sons of Israel, which is an awkward construction. One of the commentators, Stuart, says that he thinks that it's intended to be derogatory. And he gives this example. He says it would be like the difference between referring to the Mongols and referring to the Mongol hordes. That the Mongol hordes would have a more negative connotation associated with it. And he thinks that that is what's happening here. So we have the hordes of the sons of Israel. So he refers to them as this people, the sons of Israel, that are in their midst. And he says, they are more and mightier than we, which is curious. It's surprising to me that an Egyptian king would say that this people in their midst is mightier than us, the Egyptians. I have to assume it's hyperbole. It's hard for me to believe that a king of Pharaoh would actually think that this is the case, but that's what he says, as we'll see. I think he's stacking the deck, I think, trying to lay a case for taking the action that he wants to take. So there's this people that's in our midst, and they are more numerous and mightier than we. And he's going to go on to say, we need to solve this problem. But why is this a problem? And this is an interesting question. There's no hint in the text that this is currently a problem. The Pharaoh doesn't point to any evidence that in Egyptian society, the large number of sons of Israel is a problem. And as we read on in the text, the sons of Israel aren't particularly rebellious. You don't see signs of rebelliousness in them. So it's unclear why he is seeing this as a problem. And it seems to me that one could conceive of it as not being a problem. Just because there are a lot of sons of Israel in our midst, that's not necessarily a problem. As long as they are cooperating, that they are contributing to society, they aren't causing unrest of any kind, is that really a problem? And I think it's conceivable of as it being not a problem. And Joseph had not been a problem. He had been a blessing to Egypt. It's conceivable that his descendants would be a blessing to Egypt as well. I think this is kind of an interesting question in our day and age, because the issue of migrants is a huge issue right now in current events, that there are large numbers of people coming from the South into the United States, as we're all aware, from Mexico and from Central America. And people point to that as a problem, and they associate various problems with that. In addition, we've got the issue in the Middle East, where there are large numbers of people leaving, fleeing the Middle East because of the unrest there, and going through North Africa and into Europe. And that's causing complications in Europe as well. So this problem of an influx of foreigners into a society is something that we can, I think, identify with. And it's easy to see how that can be problematic. And I think we all can see that that has the potential of being problematic. Because if you have a large number of people in your midst that do not share your culture and your values, then it erodes away that basis on which your whole society is unified. And that can be very disruptive. The king of Egypt is obviously choosing to see this as a problem of that nature and appealing to the people on the basis of this being a problem of that nature. And he gives a reason, he gives a hypothetical scenario in which this could prove to be a problem of great significance to Egypt. And he says, here's what could happen. He says, come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And in the event of war, so if a war comes along, they also join themselves to those who hate us. So they join our enemy and turn against us and fight against us. And depart from the land is one way that that could be translated. The other possibility would be to take over the land. But apparently both of those are possible translations of the Hebrew. So that's the scenario that he unfolds, and that's a scary scenario. He says that's what could happen. And in current events right now, we would call that they pose an existential threat to Egypt. Okay, but the danger isn't imminent. And it isn't obvious. It takes a smart person like the king of Egypt to be able to spot it and to spell it out to the people. It's interesting that the king does not suggest driving all these people out of Egypt. And I suspect that the reason is because they have become too important economically. I mean, that's a phenomenon that we have seen, that where immigrants coming in become economically important. So to have them removed all of a sudden is problematic. And John McKay, in his commentary, points out, perhaps Pharaoh was aware of the prophecy that the sons of Israel would return to Canaan and from there would become a threat to Egypt. And I don't know about that. I don't know what the likelihood of that is. In any case, what the king does with this situation is he uses it as an opportunity to strengthen his position. I think what he wants to do is enhance his glory, give himself legitimacy, and to demonstrate that he is wise, he can foresee these kinds of problems, he is protecting his people, and he wants to use the labor of those people to build impressive buildings that will be monuments to his power and Egyptian power, and it will be a way in which he can increase his wealth at the expense of these outsiders, that is, the sons of Israel. So I think that's why the king takes the action that he takes. And the action that he takes is solution to this problem. He's going to act wisely. And Egypt has long been known for its wisdom. And throughout the ancient world, it was known for its wisdom. So he's going to think about this and act wisely. He's engaging in long-range planning. And he is so smart, he is anticipating the problem and working to solve it before it develops. And we'll talk about that more in the conclusion. What's he going to do? He's going to use overpowering force. He's going to enslave and oppress the sons of Israel. As I pointed out, he doesn't show any concern that the Israelites will rebel when that happens, which I think is interesting. He put them to work building these cities, which were storage cities. Now, storage cities were used by Egypt. They would build them on the borders of its territory as places where they could put supplies that would be used for their troops when their troops would go out to war. So he wants to build storage cities in the East Delta, where the sons of Israel are located. And in that area, there isn't much stone. So the building material is bricks, bricks made of clay that's reinforced with straw. And archaeologically, those have been found. And they've been found at the cities that are mentioned here, both Pithom and Ramses. And I pointed out there last week that there's this debate as to when the Exodus would have happened. And some argue, well, it had to have happened in the 1200s because that's when Pithom and Ramses were built. And archaeologically, that seems to be the case, that Pithom and Ramses were built and inhabited over about a 100-year to 150-year period of time in the East Delta. However, on those same locations, there were, or right next to them, there were cities that dated much further back, and they were also built with bricks reinforced with straw. And those go back to the 1800s BC. So the fact that we've got bricks reinforced with straw that were used to build buildings in this area doesn't tell us which of the dates is correct. Okay, so he's putting them to work, making these bricks, building buildings, but also doing other work, all in that East Delta area. Now, I don't think that slavery was new to the Israelites at this time. My suspicion is that they were under some form of slavery even before the events that are described here. And the reason I think that is because Egypt formed a highly centralized government in which the whole population was to one degree or another in servitude. It says God told Abraham in Genesis 15:13, he told him that his descendants would be slaves in a foreign land for 400 years. So presumably, they are slaves for a big chunk of the time that they were in Egypt. And interestingly, Joseph, when he did what he did to save Egypt, that is, buying all of the grain for 7 years when there was excess, storing it, and then selling it when there was famine for 7 years, that he accumulated a huge amount of wealth for Pharaoh. And so what he did made it possible for power and wealth to be accumulated in the hands of the king of Egypt. And we know historically that Egypt was highly centralized, that the Pharaoh had an enormous amount of wealth throughout the period of time from Joseph all the way to the time when, in the Hellenistic periods, when you get down to the time of Jesus even. So I suspect that some kind of servitude was their existence even before the events that are talked about here in Exodus, because that was the way that things were done in Egypt. So what would be happening here then is they're being put into a more servile position, that there's more rigorous control that's being exerted by the king over this group of people. Now, it's hard to put together a chronology for this early part of Exodus. There's no indication of how long these things last. But I suspect that there is a significant period of time between when this is instituted and the events that we'll read about in verse 15 and following. But that's just guesswork because it's not clear. I think it is ironic that what Joseph did to save Egypt set up the centralization of power in Egypt that then is used to enslave the descendants of Jacob within Egypt. So God, through his actions in Joseph, has set up the conditions for the later enslavement of the sons of Israel. So Pharaoh decided to make use of all this free labor. It was a manpower windfall. Sarna, in his book, Exploring Exodus, he describes it this way. Such vast public projects required an unlimited supply of labor, a high degree of organization, and the continuous production of abundant supplies of brick, masonry, and other building materials. The Pharaoh could find a large pool of manpower at hand in the delta in the Israelite population, and he proceeded to exploit it to the full. So the conditions for the Israelites became quite arduous, and I think much more arduous than they had been. It was state slavery rather than private slavery, which isn't necessarily good. It can, in many respects, that can be worse. Private slavery, at least the owner cares about your life, because if you die, he doesn't get your service. State slavery, we're talking about large numbers of people, and each individual slave becomes less significant. Sarna says, what we are dealing with is state slavery, the organized imposition of forced labor upon the male population for long and indefinite terms of service under degrading and brutal conditions. The men so conscripted received no reward for their labor, they enjoyed no civil rights, and their lot was generally much worse than that of a household slave. Organized in large work gangs, they became an anonymous mass, depersonalized, losing all individuality in the eyes of their oppressors. So that's their condition, and there's no way out. There's no end to this in sight. I want to point out, however, that as far as the Israelites were concerned, looking back on this, they did not see it as being horrible in absolutely every respect. Some of them lived quite well. There seemed to have been plenty of food. And in the wilderness, the Israelites are going to remind Moses of that on several different occasions, that things were better when they were back in Egypt, even though they were slaves. Okay, so this is the course of action that the king has set out upon. He is going to impose a harsh regime of slavery on the sons of Israel. How would this achieve its goal? I had trouble with this. Apparently, what he wants to do is make the Israelites so tired or so discouraged that they would have fewer children. So they're working so hard, they're so worn out and exhausted, and so discouraged with life that they don't have as many children. That seems to fit the wording best. It seems to me like an unreasonable expectation, but that seems to be what it's suggesting. It's possible that option two would be that the king wanted to tighten his control over the Israelites so that they would be entirely servile and present no threat. That seems more reasonable to me, but the goal that's set out by the king is to reduce the rate at which they increase in numbers or cause them to not increase at all. So I am inclined towards that first option. But as we see, the king's solution backfired. That the more the people of Israel were oppressed, the more they multiplied, the more children that they had. And that made the situation even more frightening. And when force fails, what do you do? This is a common problem historically. When you use force and it fails, what do you do? And your options are you either make concessions or you increase your force. And Pharaoh took the latter course. He increased his force. So the labor became even more bitter. And interestingly, in the Passover ceremony, the Seder plate that Israelites eat from includes bitter herbs, and those bitter herbs are a reminder of their life in Egypt under slavery. Okay, as I said, it seems to me there are quite a few things in here that we could talk about. There are more things that we can talk about than we've got time to talk about, and I would like to leave time for questions. One question here is, and a question that I've had for a long time, and I don't pretend that I can answer it adequately here, but why is anti-Semitism such a persistent evil in the world? And I, like I say, I don't know the answer to that. I think that's a very interesting question, and historically, to investigate that and get a better understanding of that, I think would be worthwhile, and I would personally like to do that. I'm confident that the answer is complicated and that there are a lot of aspects to it, but I think there's a partial answer in this passage. What was Pharaoh thinking when he imposed this regime of slavery on the people of Israel? There must have been some underlying uneasiness in Egypt that he was aware of, some uneasiness within the population. in Egypt. And he's tapping into that. He's using that as an opportunity. And he proposes a solution then that will help him to secure his power because of that fear that exists there. It's not so much that he is afraid of the threat that the Israelites pose, but he wants to use the fear that exists in society towards the Israelites as a pretense to accomplish another goal, and that is to solidify his power. Where does this underlying fear come from? And that's the question. This is not the first time that we've seen it, because it shows up a couple of times in Genesis. Isaac, and this is described in Genesis 26, 12 through 17, Isaac moved into the area where Ahimelech was the ruler, and to Gerar. And just like Abraham before him, he pretended that Rebekah was his sister rather than his wife, because he was afraid if he said that she was his wife, somebody would kill him so that they could marry Rebekah. But Ahimelech saw him embracing Rebekah, so he knew that was not his sister, and he castigated Isaac for not being forthright in telling them that was the case. And he came out with a proclamation to his people, keep your hands off of Isaac and Rebekah. Don't do anything to them. And then the text says God blessed Isaac. And then it says that the Philistines envied Isaac. So because he'd been blessed, then the Philistines begin to envy him. And then Ahimelech says, go away from us, for you are too powerful or mighty. And it's the same word that we see here in Exodus for us. Another incident in Numbers 22:3, when the Israelites are making their way up through Transjordan and they come just opposite Jericho and they're ready to enter into the promised land and they encounter the people of Moab, the Moabites become very concerned about their presence. They become afraid. And it says in Numbers 22:3, so Moab was in great fear because of the people, for they were numerous, and Moab was in dread of the sons of Israel. Several of these words here are the same ones that we see in Exodus. So it seems to me that it is truly the case that God has blessed the people of Israel. And because he has blessed them, in various ways, they have prospered. And that people around them see that and are unnerved by that. It's a kind of giftedness that's been given to them that causes the people around them to be fearful because, and I'm guessing now, but I'm guessing that the psychology behind it is that someone is gifted, how are they going to use that giftedness? And will they use that giftedness to my detriment? And that's the fear. Okay. So because of that envy then, and that uneasiness with respect to their giftedness, I think they become easy scapegoats. That seems to be what's happened here in Exodus, and that seems to be what's happened at other times in history. That's particularly ironic because the Israelites were to be a source of blessing to the world. That's what the part of the promise to Abraham was, that he would make Abraham and his descendants a blessing to those who blessed him. And given that, it would have been a blessing to the Egyptians to have the Israelites in their midst, but instead they chose to see them as a problem. And it seems to me that, especially in our culture, in a modern American culture, it rankles our democratic sensibilities to recognize a people group as being particularly blessed by God. We don't like to see anyone as being distinctive, different, especially superior in any way. And that becomes even more problematic when, though that gifted people is less than perfect, then it's easy to attach negative feelings towards them. But how we deal with the unfairness of God, it seems to me, is part of our task in the world. That there is unfairness. God has built unfairness into the world. And the question is it okay with me that God would do things the way he does things, even if it's not fair? Okay. I'm going to skip the next part because I'll come back to it later in another week. The next thing I want to talk about is this planning for the future. I think this is really interesting. Planning for the future is a double-edged sword. The Pharaoh, he sees a problem in the making, and he wants to act so that it doesn't develop before it develops. That's something that we all would like to do. We'd all like to be able to anticipate problems and nip it in the bud before it becomes a real problem. And if we could do that, it would alleviate many of our fears and insecurities. This is something that Jacques Ellul picks up on in his book, The Technological Society. It's interesting, I remember he says this with respect to law enforcement. He says that as time goes on, there will be more and more pressure to perfect law enforcement. And the pinnacle of law enforcement is stopping crime before it happens. I found it interesting that there was an editorial in the paper that was talking about that very thing, identifying school shooters before they shoot and how one would go about doing that and the importance of doing that. The problem is our ability to predict problems is very imperfect. We see problems everywhere, even where they ain't. And if we go about attacking all of those potential problems, we will keep ourselves very busy and we will do a minimum of good and we might do some bad. I think it is interesting that in a number of instances, studies have been done with respect to medical testing. And there are two kinds of testing that I'm aware of where they have come to this conclusion. One is for prostate cancer and for breast cancer, that there are studies that have shown that doing a lot of testing leads to a lot of early intervention. And sometimes that early intervention has higher risks of creating problems than no treatment at all. Because sometimes those are false positives and sometimes those will resolve themselves without any intervention at all. But aggressively going after wherever we see there might be a problem that would develop creates problems of its own. And if we are arrogant enough that we think that we can accurately identify those problems, then we are going to get ourselves into even greater problems. Okay. I think that it's fine to plan. Some of my best friends plan, but this has its limits. Okay, the third thing I want to point out. It is interesting here that God enslaved the Israelites for their own benefit. The Israelites were in a situation in Egypt where they were in a culture that in many ways it was the most advanced culture of the world. In many ways they were comfortable. Even though they were in a position of servitude, there was plenty of food, there was some comfort to be had there. And as we'll talk about next week, the people of Israel had not maintained a vivid memory of their past and what God had done for them in the past. It's pointed out by Casuto that the word that's used to refer to God in this section is Elohim. Yahweh does not show up in this section. It doesn't show up until later in Exodus. And the point that he makes of that is apparently the Torah intended to intimate thereby that since they were in a foreign land, the children of Israel were unable to preserve their spiritual attachment to Yahweh, the God of their fathers, or their knowledge of him, to which their ancestors had attained in the land of Canaan. So they're in this other culture, more advanced culture, exposed to all kinds of different ideas from the ones that had been developed in Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they're assimilating those values and those ideas. They hadn't completely forgotten, there are indications that they had not completely forgot their heritage. They hadn't completely forgot the promises. They hadn't completely forgot their history. But their assimilation had dimmed both the clarity and the importance of that past. And a point that I will make more than once is how important history is, and we'll certainly come back to that in Exodus as we go through, because God places a great deal of importance on history and remembering it. But if the Jews had not been enslaved, they would have assimilated and never left Egypt, in all likelihood. Philip Ryken quotes this statement from Charles Spurgeon, which I think is very good. He says, in all probability, if they had been left to themselves, they would have been melted and absorbed into the Egyptian race and lost their identity as God's special people. They were content to be in Egypt, and they were quite willing to be Egyptianized. To a large degree, they began to adopt the superstitions and idolatries and iniquities of Egypt, and these things clung to them in after years to such a terrible extent that we can easily imagine that their heart must have turned aside very much towards the sins of Egypt. Yet all the while, God was resolved to bring them out of that evil connection. They must be a separated people. They could not be Egyptians, nor yet live permanently like Egyptians, for Jehovah had chosen them for himself, and he meant to make an abiding difference between Israel and Egypt. So God saved his people by making their lives miserable. And then my last point is we see that God's controlling history, and we see signs of that everywhere in Egypt. He set things up. When the sons of Israel first went down, he had set things up for the slavery that was going to come. And he's setting things up for them to leave and to take the promised land. All along the way, we see signs of him being active and preparing the way for what he's going to do in the future. Everything that Pharaoh tries, and we'll see this more next week, but everything that he tries is ultimately counterproductive. God is going to win every battle with Pharaoh, without question. God had said through Jacob to Joseph, "Behold, I am about to die, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers." And that's exactly what God is in the process of doing. And it's interesting that in that 480 years while they were in Egypt, it was not clear that that's what was happening. But as we pan back in history, you can see the bigger picture and see that God is accomplishing his purposes everywhere. Okay, I left a little bit of time for questions. And if you have questions from last week, I'd be more than happy to answer those as well.
Thanks, David. Mm-hmm. Your last comments about assimilation helped with my question quite a bit, but I still have a little bit of a question about verse 9, where the king says to his people, "Look at the Israelites." So it sounds like even though the Israelites may have started to assimilate, there was something going on with them that was different enough where it was very clear when the king said to his people, all he had to say was, "Look at the Israelites," and everybody knew, oh, it's those people.
Right.
The two things I could think of would be that the Israelites would still be somewhat nomadic, even though the Egyptians were more civilized, living in cities, or that because religion and society were so integrated in Egypt, that a lack of integration into Egyptian religion would slow their integration into Egyptian society.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any ideas what the king noticed?
Well, the Israelites at this time were not nomadic. The ones living in the East Delta, they are living in cities, and they are citified.
Okay, so they still have their flocks and herds, but not in a nomadic way.
They do have some flocks and herds because there is some pastoral work that's done there by them. But for the most part, they're living in cities in Egypt. But we live in a melting pot culture in which people come from lots of different ethnic backgrounds. And once they adopt the values and the customs of America, for the most part, they are accepted as Americans. But that is a very modern phenomenon. That in ancient times, it was difficult to be accepted as an Egyptian if you were not of Egyptian blood. So it's more like if you think of Jews in Germany before the Holocaust, many of them would have said, "I was thoroughly German. Spoke German, kept German customs, all that sort of thing." But everybody in the community remembered their background was Jewish. And so when the pressure came on to identify the Jews and separate them out, they were always fingered because someone in the community remembered they were Jewish. And I think it's a similar phenomenon here that if you are an Israelite, you can't assimilate your way into being truly Egyptian. You'll always be an Israelite, even if you adapt the customs. Now, having said that, it does appear that they are not fully assimilated. There's still some differences. There are probably some cultural differences that have persisted, but they have, to a significant degree, assimilated. And so what Spurgeon is arguing is, if there had been more time that had gone, they would have more fully assimilated into Egyptian culture.
Okay, so it sounds like it's not a question of assimilation per se, but a question of a new king in a time of transition with possible problems on the horizon, leveraging fear and pointing the finger at a group that all of a sudden all his people think, oh, they're everywhere.
Yeah, okay. That the existence of another people in their midst, even if they're assimilated, even if they were fully assimilated, is a threat to them. And I think analogous to what happened in Germany, that the Jews in the midst, even if they had fully Germanized, were a concern, were a threat.
And David, you had mentioned the Hyksos as well. They were Canaanite people, were they not?
Who was?
The Hyksos.
It's not clear. Mm-hmm. They came from Canaan, mm-hmm. but it's not clear how long they had lived in Canaan. Mm-hmm. So their origins going back are unclear. They may have only been in Canaan for a relatively short period of time. They built cities there, mm-hmm. so they must have been there for a number of years, but yes.
It makes you wonder if the king who had just come to power, you mentioned that one of the possibilities was that this is a pharaoh replacing the Hyksos. If the memory, the recent memory is, we just had these Canaanite overlords.
Right.
And those guys, those Israelites, they're from Canaan too.
Right.
They pose a threat of joining right. with those people we just kicked out.
Right.
So
that's very possible. And the Hyksos, they were referred to by the Egyptians as the shepherd kings. And if you remember in Genesis, the Egyptians would not eat with the Israelites because they were herders of flocks, and that was objectionable to the Egyptians. So there was a lot of tension between those groups.
I just want to thank you for including that last sentence. I think that's become really meaningful to me. It's clear that God is accomplishing his purposes. I think that's just so evident in this, as well as much of the Old Testament. One of the questions about assimilation, the Hebrew language, how did that develop and when? Because it's often a language that keeps a people distinct, you know, if they have their own language.
And
can you say something about the Hebrew language and when that?
Well, Hebrew is closely related to the languages that were spoken in Canaan. But if the question is, when did Hebrew as a language distinguish itself from Canaanite, I don't know the answer to that. The patriarchs appear to have spoken the language that was spoken in Canaan and that develops into Hebrew. But when those part their ways and when Hebrew takes the form that we see it in the Bible, I don't know the answer to that.
The Israelites were probably not speaking Egyptian as their mother tongue.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Obviously, they retained a knowledge of the language that had been spoken in Canaan. Whether they were speaking that as their primary language or whether they had assimilated to the point that they are speaking Egyptian as their first language, I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah, because even here in the U.S., that's what sets people apart, is if they're still speaking their own language. And in many countries, they might have one trade language or something, but many countries, even today, have multiple languages, and that's what really sets people apart.
Right. And we know archaeologically that strip on the East Delta was heavily populated with Semites, Western Semites, so Canaanites, from 1800 BC on. So there would have been a large group of people there that was speaking a related language. But the question of how much they had assimilated Egyptian, I don't know the answer to that. And I've wondered, that's an interesting question. Anything else? Okay.